these gentlemen have also done us a great pleasure sitting on the panel. So I'll just turn it over to Bob now.
All right. Well, I've been waiting to be on top of all these guys sooner or later. They're usually ones telling me what to do. So, I think we've had a lot of good questions on renewables, and I think we can focus this a lot more as to what people really want without somewhat of an agenda. But if we could quickly go through the same way we did the first session and let people do a minute or two about who they are and where they've come from to have an idea of their background, I think that would help to drive some good questions. Jeff, go ahead.
I'm Jeff Brooks from NC Green Power. I am the marketing coordinator of the program. Basically, as far as my duties go, involve promoting the program, working with the media, managing our speakers bureau. So we're out in the field doing a lot of what we're doing today. Just getting the word out about our program. We are a nonprofit program that works to encourage the development of renewable energy projects in North Carolina. We're trying to get more green power on the grid. And we do that through voluntary contributions from citizens just like you who care about the environment and want to make a contribution to a cleaner North Carolina. So we talk about it today. We hope you'll consider joining the 10,000 other people that are doing it in our state and making solar, wind, and methane gas projects and other such technologies a reality for North Carolina.
All right. My name is Henry Tai. I work for the North Carolina Solar Center. My primary job function is to run several projects that have to do with renewable energy. Two of them are more academically based research on the economics of biofuels. One of them is actually a little bit more applied type of a program where I would serve as the incubator for small business startups in North Carolina. And there are some faces here that are currently working on some of these projects. So I'm very glad to be here. And then the rest of the time, I spend keeping Steve Callen, my boss, out of trouble. So,
yeah. you're not doing your job.
Thanks.
We'll give you that scorecard later, I suppose.
Yeah.
Phil.
My name's Phil Brown. I teach chemistry here at NC State, and I do several other tasks as well. This is. First of all, I just want to thank the coordinators and the people that put this on. This is a small group, but this is a very important group. I've never been more optimistic in my life. I've been sitting here for 2 hours now, and I get tingles thinking about every opportunity. This is a topic that touches virtually every facet that I can imagine, and I'm as excited as I could, obviously, as you can tell, as I could be. My role in fuels research started very early when I was a kid. I had a mini bike, and then I went and lived in Denmark for a period of time, gave up my mini bike, and I started riding bicycles everywhere. And if you've had a chance to be in Copenhagen, everybody from 3-year-old children to 80-year-old grandmothers rides bicycles everywhere in Denmark. And, I just thought that this was just a marvelous way. So I've had a lifelong passion in cycling. But then a pragmatic side quickly emerged when I used to commute back and forth to NC State from my house near Jordan Lake. I was hit not once, but you can see my tattoo. I have been hit twice by cars commuting to school. So I figured this is not going to be a very practical way, even though it was marvelous. It was just not a good way to commute that distance. So I began thinking of alternatives, and fortunately a friend of mine was selling his old Mercedes. Being a chemist, I know how to make biodiesel. It's a very simple process, and I can help anybody who wishes to get into this. I've given many workshops, and many communities have hosted, just a visit. There's no charge. Matter of fact, I provide all the supplies, and I'll teach you how to find a decent vehicle and actually get it running. I haven't paid for fuel in almost 2.5 years now. That's nice. I have 2 old cars and a tractor, and my daughter drives one. I drive the other, and my wife quite hasn't come on. on board yet, but so yeah, that's probably it. So, but they but it's exactly it is a dynamic field, one with a huge growth potential, and I'm looking forward to today's conversation.
Well, I'm Steve Callen. I'm the director of the Solar Center here at NC State. We're part of the College of Engineering, and we are largely sponsored by soft money grants, including a large amount of money that comes from the State Energy Office here in the state. So we're kind of in a strange role of functioning as both a university education and outreach function, and here at a land-grant university, we do a lot of extension work as well as research work. But we also kind of serve as a consultant to a lot of state agencies and to the General Assembly and others in the policy arena on how to develop appropriate framework policies to set up the markets for all these new technologies. The Solar Center really started as a solar center in 1988. We built a solar house here first in 81 and then got into passive solar design and solar thermal. And it's been in recent years that we've diversified into photovoltaics or solar electricity. That's not photovoltaics, by the way, it's photovoltaics. You can pronounce that correctly if you use it. But we also do work in fuel cells and hydrogen technologies. We do work in wind energy, bioenergy, biofuels. We do a lot of work in green buildings, including running the state's Healthy Built Homes program, the state green building program for residential construction on behalf of the State Energy Office. And basically cover a lot of ground in all of these areas. We do research work, we do policy work, we do K-12 outreach work, we do general technical assistance to the general public. We run a 1-800 number so that anybody and their brother can call us, and I refer them all to Henry. We cover a lot of ground with a fairly small staff at this point. So we're in a little bit of a state of flux. Being a soft money funded entity, the State Energy Office this year is actually running out of grant money. And so we are working for the very first time to get a state appropriation to keep the center open here at NC State. There is a bill that our senator here in Raleigh, Senator Cowell, has put forward to fund the center on an ongoing basis for about $2.4 million. And if that passes, we will be growing some as a center. So we're feeling pretty positive about the way things are going at this point, but it's a shaky future. Come see me in September and we'll find out if I'm giving you one of my resumes or if I'm accepting resumes.
We're going to certainly going to hope that we get to keep a lot of the talent in North Carolina from the Solar Center here. So I'm going to suggest we start off with some discussion on the adoption of these technologies and what the panel sees on this and some of the potential hurdles to that. Henry, I know, can speak to a lot of that, and Jeff also has a lot of contact. So, I mean, that's it. I want to do a quick brief on what they're thinking about. The future is looking bright in everyone's minds, I believe. But, Jeff, what do you see about NC Green Power? How do you see that? And what's the growth pattern that you're seeing with NC Green Power?
Well, we've actually seen some pretty exciting growth in the past year. Our program, from a subscription standpoint, meaning the people who give contributions to our program, has increased over 25% in the last year, which is very, very good. What we've also seen in the past year is we've gone from around 12 small solar suppliers to about 53 in the past year. We have also brought online two landfills, two wind projects with a third on the way. In fact, we're dedicating one wind project that the Solar Center partnered on, and the State Energy Office has had some things to do with in several groups. Next Friday in Coquina Beach on the Outer Banks, we're going to be dedicating that wind turbine. So that's very exciting. What we've kind of sort of jokingly referred to 2006 as the year of the resource for our program, because we really have seen so many resources coming online. It's almost been a frenzy to keep up with it, and that's been very exciting. We find that the incentives that we offer in our program have been very attractive to small solar producers. In many cases, they are I would venture to guess that one of the primary means of making those projects economically viable. So it's been a very positive effect on that industry, but we've also seen it be very effective in other industries. With landfills, even though they're fairly cost competitive right now with fossil fuels, they do need a little bit of incentive, and even just the little bit we provide them on that is enough to make their projects viable. What is exciting to us is that our phone never stops ringing. Some days that's not exciting, but most days that's exciting. And the fact that we're constantly getting inquiries from the media, from other groups that are very excited. There's an excitement around North Carolina, I think, in relation to renewable energy. And I think that we're seeing, even with the small wind turbines that are going up, the first steps that are testing the waters to see, you know, will North Carolina support larger scale wind? You know, we don't expect our efforts to stop at a small wind project that powers one home. We want to open the door to more and more projects over the coming months and years. So I think in many respects, North Carolina is at a point where for renewable energy, it's the brightest that it's ever been. And it's nice to see the legislature passing incentives and things that are available to help homeowners. And we hope that kind of cooperation between government, the private sector, and our organization and other groups will continue, because it's been very productive.
I'm going to put everyone here on the spot and say, who here is a NC Green Power subscriber?
Good.
That's really good. So for everyone else who doesn't understand exactly, you pay $4 a month, and that supports renewable energy in North Carolina and all the different things that Jeff just described. So I would encourage everyone here to commit to $4 a month. It's a cup of coffee.
Yeah,
I buy three blocks, one for each of my kids.
Yeah, exactly. So
exactly.
You buy blocks of four. So
every $4 is going to pay for the generation of 100 kilowatt hours of renewable energy that's going to be put on the grid here in North Carolina. We've got some brochures over on the table over there. If it's something that you'd like information, I hope each of you would take one and consider it. Because really, it is you that's investing in these projects. It's really you that's making them possible through your contributions, and they are tax deductible contributions. And we can't, you know, people say, well, can you bring on more resources? Can you bring on more stuff? And the answer to that question is yes, if we have you, the contributor, continuing to participate in our program. That's what empowers us to be able to bring more resources online.
And it's the cheapest feel-good money you ever have. Quite honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, Henry, how about you as far as adoption of some of the thermal or PV technologies? I know you've done some financial models I've seen. What do you think is the greatest barrier, or what do you think is the status of things moving forward?
Well, I probably want to start off the conversation by addressing a more fundamental issue concerning how this country invests in its long-term assets. And what I mean by that is, you know, for all of you who are MBA students here, we tend to think that perhaps the capitalism and the corporations that work in capitalism are really better at allocating money, that is, kind of diverting capital to its best use, and that government itself is better at managing people's behavior. And I think a lot of the issues that arise out of the things that we're seeing today that connect energy to things like national security, global warming, those things are indeed some of the aspects in which government will try to modify the behavior of the consumers. And so you get into a problem when those two forces, I think, are in conflict. And what I mean when I first start out this sentence, when I say investment behavior, is that, you know, ultimately, you know, in the American capital market, we tend to have a very short investment horizon. It's what economists typically call the Anglo-Saxon model, is that we go from earning period to earning period, as opposed to the German-Japanese model of investment, which is more long-term. They have a more vested interest from their bankers and their debt markets to manage these corporations in the long term. And those are one of the things that I think are responsible for the growth of PV markets in Germany and Japan, is because that cultural and investment behavior has a 20, 30-year horizon, as opposed to us here in the U.S., where we have a very, very short investment horizon, and indeed may even have problems saving enough to fight inflation. One of the thoughts that I had before I got here is to actually perhaps parallel the issue with Social Security in terms of investment horizons. In this country, we tend to give a lot of value to anything that's present. And those of you who have taken finance in the MBA program, of course, the discount rate comes to mind. But, you know, essentially, the issue with Social Security that we face right now and all things that surround that can be tied to the same way that we view the time horizons of most of the energy technologies that we see. We have this, in this country, this view that 20 years out, we can continue to be investing in the same manner that we do today. So I think underneath technology, from an economic basis, I think that's an important aspect that's worth exploring.
Short-term views of quarterly profits.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Right.
So, Phil, how about on your side from the biotechnologies and biodiesel?
Yeah. With all technologies, there's always some downsides. And we're starting to see a little bit of a backlash right now in some of the biofuels sectors. This audience I wouldn't have to educate, but you know, a lot of people don't realize that making biofuels comes at a significant cost. You have to have the land, you have to have the fertilizer, sometimes you are taking crops. If you're going to get your biofuels from a crop that's currently a food source for animals or livestock or for people, then that's going to be a cost that we're going to have to absorb. So in the bioethanol arena, that gets most of the press because that's where the big automakers right now, Ford and GM, have their flex fuel vehicles. Those are all ethanol-based vehicles. And there's a lot of debate into how much energy cost is reaped from how much energy is supplied. So the big mantra now is getting away from food crops and going to cellulosic ethanol. When I finished up my time in Pittsburgh, I started a company with some other chemists and a physician at Duke, and it was called Enzyme Technology Research, and we were looking at the feasibility of making fuels from corn, essentially. And we had a lot of strains of enzymes and enzyme preparations that showed promise, but very early on we saw the handwriting was on the wall, and that if you looked at all the costs involved, this was not going to be feasible. We didn't let our buyer of the company know that, but Lilly ended up purchasing Enzyme Technologies, and the three of us retired, and then we had to go find other means to spend our lives. And that's when I started to be intrigued by diesel engines, and I started reading a lot of Adolf Diesel's writings and began experimenting myself using straight vegetable oils, rapeseed oils, a lot of different kinds of crops, and came to the conclusion that it would be better if I actually processed the oil into making a fuel, and that's where I am now, and hopefully some patents will come through and we'll start another company here within the next year or so. And No. I enjoy my time here, and it's been a unique experience to see fuels research come full cycle. I don't know, most of you know diesel was around back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and this is very old technology that works quite well. And my engines in my cars and my tractor, all of them have, well, not my tractor, but in my cars, they all have over 500,000 miles on them. And they're remarkably soot-free, clean-burning, smooth, very quiet compared to any diesel fuel you can imagine. And when you look at the emissions that come out of that vehicle, they're also very small. And every carbon atom that came out of that exhaust pipe was actually part of a plant. So there was a sequestering of the carbon dioxide, what we call a zero gain. The carbon dioxide comes out of the atmosphere, makes the fuel, you burn the fuel, you put it back into the atmosphere, the plants then turn it back into the fuel, and you've closed what we call the carbon loop. And that was something very intriguing to me as well. So I see in the Japanese model, they call it a death by a thousand cuts. Well, this is a life by a thousand technologies. Diesel will play a very small part, ethanol a small part. If you put into your little browser, teslamotors.com, most of you probably are aware of Tesla Motors. They developed a sports car, an electric sports car that can go 200 miles on a single charge, 250 miles on a single charge, can go 0 to 60 in less than 4 seconds. It is an extraordinarily high-performance vehicle. Well, that same company is now thinking about not elite cars for very wealthy people, but technology for the masses. So then my thoughts turned to investment, and I wanted to know how I could get into some of these early technologies, and it turns out to be a very difficult thing. And this is where I'll probably have to get the help of some of the MBA students. Where can I put my investment dollars into good new transportation technologies? But I think there's a world of valuable things coming down the pipe and going to really make the air cleaner, our cars last longer. There's still the opportunity cost. You know, roads are not very friendly things to the environment. I would love it if we could all have nice cities, condensed environments, everybody ride a bicycle or walk, as our previous speakers had mentioned, but I'm a pragmatist. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we love our cars. I'm not from California, but I think we love our cars. We love to drive down to the beach, and I think we're just going to have to do the best we can with what we have available. So,
sounds good.
It's my pitch.
Steve, how about your thoughts?
Well, I have to say, you know, I've been doing this since I got out of grad school in 1993, and it's been a steady build towards perhaps the most exciting moment, you know, in energy that I've seen. And, you know, looking back historically, you know, there hasn't been a time like this since Jimmy Carter was in the White House telling everybody to wear sweaters and turn the thermostat down. But there's a major difference between then and now, which is it looks a lot more like the conditions that have brought us to all of this excitement in the media and all of this concern at the gas station when you go to fill up your car, and all of this concern when you read in the newspaper that they want to build new nuclear power plants or coal-fired power plants. All of these issues are here, and they're not going to go away. You know, the oil price spikes in the 70s, you know, were temporary phenomena, and they generate a lot of attention, but they weren't permanent. Climate change is not going to go away, and policymakers are going to start to really ratchet down on a framework to deal with those kinds of issues. And I think this is where I'm really excited to be at my second business school meeting on sustainability in the last few weeks here, because the thing that's really missing in the equation to figure out how all this works, there's two pieces that are going to get us there. One is the policy framework. I know business school people hate it when I say that. Henry gets his hair stands on end every time I say that, you know, he's working in a policy framework. But public policy is the framework for the marketplace. And right now, we have a framework that's been set up on 150 years worth of path-dependent model, looking at central station power, with no concern about emissions and no concern about carbon and no concern about a lot of externalities. And what's starting to happen is the marketplace is going to be allowed to operate, but they're going to change the boundaries for that marketplace and how it's going to operate. And right now, in North Carolina, of all places, we're going to become the gateway to those kinds of policy shifts for the Southeast. This year, I predict that we will pass a renewable portfolio standard here in North Carolina. Is everybody familiar with that term? People know what that means. The idea is that you're going to put in a policy that says that a percentage of electric power generated in a state must come from renewable energy. And, you know, we have that in states like California and New Jersey. You know, to have that in a place like North Carolina is, you know, to some extent a seismic shift. This year we're going to pass some sort of legislation relating to development of biofuels in the state. There's a proposal right now for a $32 million grant to be put into a strategic plan for biofuels development for North Carolina to move us to some of the next generation technologies in cellulosic ethanol to help figure out how to deal with the infrastructure problems of delivering biofuels. There are tax credits pending in the General Assembly this year for green homes, a $1,000 per house tax credit for Energy Star homes, a $2,000 per house tax credit for healthy built homes, the state's green building program. There are bills out there for improving energy efficiency in state government buildings. There's a whole array of legislation out there that's not only in the General Assembly, but is likely to pass, which is, you know, a real shift from where we were just 5 years ago. And if you look at a state, I mean, you know, California, Arnold Schwarzenegger's on the cover of Newsweek this month talking about, you know, his leadership role in moving state policy forward across the country. But, you know, Maryland, which is, you know, not exactly noted for its progressivity over the last few years on these topics, 2 days ago they passed into law the strongest renewable portfolio standard in the East and one of the best solar programs in the world. There's going to be they're going to require 2% of electric retail sales in the state to come from solar energy, and 10% of all of their power to come from renewable energy. 2% of solar, that's a huge number in terms of what we're currently doing in this country in terms of solar. That's thousands of megawatts of solar, which is a lot. It's not a lot in terms of power. That's like two nuclear plants. But for solar, that's an economy of scale jump that's going to actually drive down costs to a point where this makes a lot more sense and gets a lot more packageable. Which brings me back to you guys. I can't tell you how exciting it is to see MBA students that care. Because the biggest shortage that we have in renewable energy is guys that know what you guys know. Marketing skills, finance skills, project development skills. Now, those types of folks have always gone to the traditional power sector if they get into energy at all. And they've worked in electric utilities and places like that. You know, a lot of the solar companies have historically been run by engineers who came up with technology. And while being in the College of Engineering, I have a soft spot in my heart for engineers. God help you if you're an engineer trying to run a company and take it private or take it public or try and grow it or pretty much anything. I say that. My boss is the dean's not in the room, right? You know, we need you guys. And so to find business students that are not only interested in sustainability, but are interested in renewables and that are going to get into this marketplace and find jobs taking these technologies and coming up with the innovative financing models that help us get past this two-year time horizon by coming up with some mechanism that's going to make that look more attractive in the American Anglo-Saxon mindset, which is something that Henry's done some work on. You know, those kinds of things are what we really need because the technology is there. You know, it wasn't there when Jimmy Carter was telling us to wear sweaters, and we paid the price for that. We tried to put in policy mechanisms, huge federal tax credits for solar back in the 70s. It brought every tin man in the United States into the solar business. We installed a lot of really bad product. We even installed a lot of really good product badly. And then Reagan came in and said, tax credits, bah, I hate renewable energy, let's get rid of that. And all those tin men left the industry. What that accomplished was it left every bad solar system in the United States marooned out there with no one in the yellow pages to come fix it. It gave solar a real black eye, which, you know, to some extent, the water heating industry has never recovered from. You know, so we're at a point now where, A, a lot of those people died off, thank God, or not so, thank God. You know what I mean. You know, so we're getting to a point where we can get past some of those historic problems and have a clean slate to work with. We've got the people in the room here that know how to make it work from a company perspective. The technology is there. The media is all over it. The politicians are finally getting it, and they're setting up the policy framework so that you guys can make it work. You know, I'm excited. It's great right now.
I would agree that it's everywhere in the media. Let's open up to some questions. We've got a talented group of people up here. Who's got some thoughts?